Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Believe me, if I started murdering people, there'd be none who get left.
We are all evil in some form or another.
Now, I am not guilty.
Brooke Wilberger was born on February 20th, 1985, to parents Greg and Cammy. She was in the middle of a brood of six children in a close-knit Latter-day Saint family. Her siblings, Stephanie, Spencer, Bryce, Shannon, and Jessica, and her were all raised in Elmira, Oregon, near Eugene. She grew up in a home filled with faith, responsibility, and love, and her family described her as bright, grounded, and faithful. She wasn't the showy type of kid and was more quiet and reserved than some of her other siblings. A girl with a warm smile and a quiet strength. What made Brooke stand out to her was her dependability and her reliability and her willingness to work hard and help others, generous with her time and resources almost to a fault. In 2003, Brooke graduated from Elmira High School, and she was the kind of student that you would expect would succeed. She was thoughtful, driven, conscientious. So after high school, she enrolled at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. It was a school that reflected her faith and her values, and she was accepted there, where she planned to study speech pathology. Brooke had struggled with speech when she was little, and she wanted to work with other people with similar issues and help them. In the spring of 2004, after completing her first year at Brigham, she came home for the summer to stay with her older sister Stephanie and her husband Zach in Corvallis, which is a college town for Oregon State University, and where Stephanie and her husband Zach had managed this apartment complex, which was called the Oak Park Apartments. Justin, her boyfriend, whom she had known for most of her life, and then they had started dating when they were both 16, he was actually completing a missionary trip in Venezuela, and then he would be returning in a few weeks after that. They had both decided on Brigham to complete their studies, and like everyone just sort of expected that after graduation, a wedding would probably soon follow. Brooke had agreed to help Stephanie with some of the upkeep of the properties, and she was really looking forward to filling her summer with getting her hands a little bit dirty doing some good old-fashioned manual labor. On the morning of May 24th, 2004, the weather was warm. It was a clear day, so it was one of those shorts and flip-flops kind of day. So 19-year-old Brooke took a bucket of soapy water and some like cloths that she was going to use to clean the glass covers of the parking lot lights. And Stephanie had looked out their apartment window around 10 a.m. and saw Brooke working out there. And by lunchtime, Stephanie had kind of expected that Brooke would have worked up quite an appetite and come in to make herself a sandwich or something. So she headed out to ask her if like she wanted something to eat, and she saw the bucket of water sitting below one of the light fixtures with a rag just kind of tossed over the edge of the bucket. But Brooke wasn't anywhere around or anywhere near this bucket. Now, Stephanie would have just gone back inside, assuming that she had, you know, taken a bathroom break and they had maybe just missed each other, passing each other in the hallways or something. But Brooke's flip-flops were sitting near the pavement of the parking lot and sitting kind of askew. But one of the rubber kind of bands had, like from the sandal, had come loose and was broken. So where could Brooke have gone without her sandals? Like, she wasn't really the barefoot type. And something about this broken sandal felt very ominous to Stephanie. So back at Stephanie's apartment, Brooke's phone, her purse, and her car keys were all still there. But Brooke had just seemingly vanished. And as I said, Brooke was reliable. Like, she was not just the type to wander off or give up on life and go with strangers or something. She especially wasn't the type to sort of quit a task right in the middle of it. So Stephanie called some family members and they decided to call the police. Like, as a group, they made that decision and do it right away. And the police believed the family about Brooke having not left of her own accord. And so they treated her disappearance as an abduction right from the very beginning, largely based on the fact that she had left all of her belongings, including her wallet and phone, behind. Now, early witnesses all described this green van that was kind of circling the area that morning, which was a great clue because it described and was witnessed by more than one, like, independent source. But without a license plate, it really kind of proved impossible to track down. The search for Brooke was one of the largest searches in Oregon history, with hundreds of volunteers, including, of course, family members, friends, and neighbors of Stephanie's. They scoured fields, forested areas, deserted back roads, dumpsters. Flyers went up picturing Brooke's pretty and engaging smile that really could have been anyone's daughter, sister, friend, or coworker. But despite the leads and all of the volunteers, the trail was really difficult. So the police had investigated several possible suspects. Now, at one point, they focused on this man named Sungkoo Kim, who was later convicted of, like, unrelated theft and burglary charges, but he was eventually cleared in Brooke's case. But his arrest caused, well, kind of months of distraction and kind of going the wrong way with things. However, when you cast such a wide net for suspects, it often tends to come up with other bottom feeders. So it did bring justice to Mr. Kim for being a thief, but what they needed was a kidnapper, and probably a murderer is what they're thinking at this point. The family worked really hard to keep Brooke's face and memory in the media, to keep some hope for finding her alive. They held vigils, press conferences. Brooke's disappearance was featured more than once on America's Most Wanted, but still they really came up with nothing. Meanwhile, Cammie and Greg and all of her siblings, as well as Justin, just all they could do was pray and hope that as each day drew to a close, that they were coming closer and closer to the reality that Brooke might never be found. Like, in their hearts, they all felt that she really was no longer alive, but what they really wanted was answers to where she was and what had happened to her, and then, of course, justice for whoever, if anyone, had been responsible for her disappearance. Stephanie, in particular, carried a burden of misplaced guilt over, you know, putting her to work that fateful spring day. The green van that witnesses had mentioned in the area, that just kind of kept circling around the investigators' brains. And on that same day in May that Brooke had disappeared, there had actually been two separate reports from young like college-aged women from Oregon State that had both said that they had been approached that morning by a man in a green van who had tried, thankfully unsuccessfully, to lure them into the van. And the man was a stranger to both women, so they just felt that there were too many coincidences between these reports and Brooke's disappearance. So the man in the green van kind of had to be their guy. But even with descriptions from the two women, it really didn't narrow it down for them. Meanwhile, over in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on November 30th, 2004, a foreign exchange student was viciously attacked and assaulted, and fortunately managed to survive her attack. Now, in her case, she managed to pick out this drifter named Joel Patrick Courtney from this lineup. And so he was arrested and he was like in jail awaiting trial for this assault. Now, New Mexico is a long way from Oregon, but guess where this asshole was from? That's right, Oregon. And he had actually been living in Corvallis in May of 2004. Oh, and he was also driving around in a green van. Now, Joel had a rather long history of violence against women, often strangers to him. So when this background check on him turned up that he had been arrested in New Mexico, they started to wonder if maybe he might be Brooke's abductor as well.
In November, he was arrested in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for a very similar crime. The detectives there then did background work to figure out what's this guy's deal, what's his background. They called police in Oregon, and that started the ball rolling with him then as a very big suspect in this case.
So they start to use the time that he's in prison for this New Mexico assault to investigate him a little bit further, which seems like a really great thing to like use the time he can't escape and maybe get rid of evidence or something like that. But for some reason, it always seems to feel like they procrastinate and leave everything to the 0 hour before this person gets released. Kind of feels like it happened in this case, but I also know that it does take a long time to build a strong case when you're waiting for DNA results and testing and whatnot. So we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt here. But for family, the waiting is just so very painful. Like, I just can't imagine. So Joel had pled guilty to the attack on the New Mexico exchange student. So he was sentenced in 2007. So building a case against Joel for Brooke's murder would take until 2008. They had no body, no evidence, like no evidence that Brooke was actually dead. Now, they did manage to find some of her DNA and a hair sample of hers in his creepy green van. And the Oregon witnesses had identified him from photos as the driver of this van in Oregon. So he was charged with her murder back in 2005.
We'd like to thank all of you who have joined with us over this past year in searching and trying to find Brooke. Our main goal remains the same, to find her and see that justice is served. We believe families are eternal and Brooke will be with our family forever.
But it wasn't to be a very tight case because they didn't have her remains or like a confession. And of course, Joel wasn't talking. Now, the DNA did put Brooke in his van, but it wasn't proof that he had killed her.
We are at a milestone in this case in that on Friday, July 29th, last Friday, the Benton County Grand Jury reviewed this case, the case of Brooke Wilberger. The grand jury, after hearing all of the evidence, returned a 19-count indictment accusing Joel Patrick Courtney, who's 39 years old, of 14 counts of aggravated murder alleged in alternative theories, 2 counts of aggravated kidnapping in the first degree, 1 count of first-degree rape, 1 count of first-degree sexual abuse, and 1 count of first-degree sodomy. Under Oregon law, the maximum possible penalty for aggravated murder is death.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
But the DA's office in Oregon had a little bit of a plan for Joel. So in 2008, they extradited him to Benton County, Oregon, to stand trial on these charges for the kidnapping and murder of Brooke, and that they would be seeking the death penalty. Now, getting the death penalty for a case with no body and really not that much evidence that Brooke's actually dead would be a tough go. But Joel didn't really know that and was a little bit terrified, obviously, of the death penalty. So although the family, of course, wanted justice for Brooke, what they wanted more was information, like where was Brooke and like what had been done to her. Like, so they saw the charges against Joel as progress, but they knew that a trial was not going to give them those answers, like the ones that they so desperately wanted. So in September of 2008, when the DA offered Joel this deal of taking the death penalty off the table in exchange for a guilty plea that would come with a full confession, they were 100% supportive of that. Because if he gave up the information, he would get a conviction for aggravated murder and then get life in prison with no parole. So the family felt that this was considered enough justice. Now, I don't think I've talked about this here on the podcast before, but if you have been at all following or aware of the Moscow, Idaho murders, then you might be familiar then with this tactic for avoiding long, drawn-out, expensive trials. When Brian Kohlberger pleaded guilty, which just a few months ago now, to the murders of Kaylee, Madison, Zanna, and Ethan that had happened on November 13th of 2022, there was a lot of controversy over that. Like, and even from some of the family members that felt that, like, taking this guilty plea, I think it was the word plea that really got them, in order to not risk the death penalty, like a sentence that I think we can all conjecture he likely would have gotten, was a disgrace. It was terrible. Like, it was a slap in the face to justice. But I respectfully disagree on that. Now, normally I don't like plea bargains, especially when it takes like a crime like murder and then knocks it down to like manslaughter or a rape case that becomes like simple assault. Those kinds of plea deals are definitely slaps in the face. But I understand also that they have a place in the justice system, as juries, of course, are a little bit persnickety and trials are very expensive, resources, blah, blah, blah. But the good thing about taking a guilty plea is that there's no trial, but more importantly, no appeals. So families want justice, like that is definitely true. But the information and that closure part, like I think that when families go through a full trial with photos and evidence and then they end in like hung juries or acquittals, that is true pain for a family to go through. Or a family that goes through years of appeals, trials, like those wounds just get reopened. So in my family's case, with Dustin pleading guilty to the murders of Taylor, Sean, and Alan was a true gift for us as a family. I mean, I'm not going to be going thanking him because I don't think he did it out of the goodness of his heart, but rather because I think he realized he was completely fuckered. But still, to not have to have my sister, my mom, or like any of the kids in the family have to sit through all of that evidence. And in our case, we never now have to worry about his conviction being overturned. Like, all we now have to worry about is parole hearings down the road. So when the only thing on the table to remove in order to get a guilty plea and have the guy spend the rest of his life in prison, like, to me, that's kind of a no-brainer, and I don't think it should be controversial. And in Brooke's case, the family saw it that the same way that I do. They wanted to know where Brooke was more than they wanted to take the chance of like a rogue jury acquitting the bastard, which was something that really could have happened in this case for kind of the lack of evidence that they had. And all they would be getting out of that is the possibility of the death penalty, which isn't really much of a thing anymore. It takes so many years to get to that point that a life in prison seems to be actually more justice anyways in a lot of cases. And in 2008, aggravated murder was the only crime that was subject to capital punishment in Oregon. So it was kind of a standard move to go after the death penalty specifically for the purpose of having some room to play as far as trying to get a guilty plea that comes with the person having to lay out the details of the crime. So pulling the death penalty in exchange for the location of Brooke's remains was a fair trade, because recovering her for a proper memorial was worth the risk of a trial. And I don't think people realize in a lot of cases how re-traumatizing a trial can be, especially in a capital trial where laying out the gruesomeness of the crime is kind of important to the prosecution in order to get that sentence. So Cammy and Greg released a statement at the time saying, quote, "We remain committed to the recovery of Brooke's remains and fully support the Benton County District Attorney's efforts to do so within a reasonable period of time. In a criminal case, there can be a fully contested trial and there can be a negotiated resolution. We completely support the Benton County District Attorney's Office in their approach to the case, whether through trial or a timely negotiated resolution," end quote. Now, however, according to the Daily Herald, the DA, John Haroldson at the time, did not actually consult with the family before making the deal. But we have to remember that DAs actually work for the state and not for the family. So on September 21st, 2009, Joel Courtney stood before a judge and Brooke's family to plead guilty and tell them that he had left Brooke's body off of a logging road, which was just off of Highway 20, so just west of Corvallis, between like Blodgett and Wren.
Not much has been disclosed in the Wilberger case about where the crime actually took place. Authorities say it happened in the woods in Benton County in Coastal Range. And for the people who live in that area, they say they can't believe something like this could have happened in their backyard. On Highway 20, just about 15 miles west of Corvallis, sits the town of Blodgett.
This is a real, you know, nice community, and, you know, bad stuff is just never happens out here. It just doesn't.
But people here started to question that reputation after authorities disclosed a few details about where Brooke Wilberger was murdered.
They said coastal region, Benton County, and Benton County only goes so far.
Leading many locals here to think this deserted road was the location Joel Courtney took Brooke Wilberger the day he killed her.
It's kind of eerie that he went and, you know, he could have been in here. He could have been in here the next day, the day before.
Mark Scacco owns the Blodgett Country Store, which is about 3 miles from where he thinks the crime was committed. He says he's surprised it could have happened so close to home.
Some of us actually did search that area because it's a little abandoned road, and nobody'd seen anything. So, you know, if something wants to be hidden, it can be hidden very well.
And there, hidden beneath a fallen tree and camouflaged with moss and ferns, were Brooke's remains. And when she was found, searchers had actually realized that they had walked by that very spot a number of years before. He had hidden her so well that they really never stood a chance of finding her without his help.
The green minivan is the link.
Now, Joel also had to tell the court what he had done. And he says that on May 24th, 2004, he had circled the town looking for victims. And after failing to abduct the two other women that he had spotted, he saw Brooke working in the parking lot. He threatened her with a knife, forced her into his creepy green van, bound her with duct tape, and then drove her out to this Coast Range logging road. He kept her alive overnight, which is terrifying. The next day, he assaulted her sexually, and when she fought back is when he killed her. He bludgeoned her with a heavy object. Brooke had resisted right up until the very end. So investigators confirmed the recovery of her body, but had initially withheld where it actually was to just sort of protect the scene until they could finish up the search. It was dental records and some of her personal effects that confirmed her identity for them.
Missing person posters are being taken down for Brooke Wilberger. More than 5 years after she disappeared, police in Oregon have finally located the remains of the 19-year-old college student. Wilberger was on summer break from Brigham Young University in 2004 when she was abducted from a parking lot in her native Oregon. The man charged in her killing, Joel Courtney, has pleaded guilty to murder and admitted raping Wilberger before bludgeoning her to death and hiding her body in the wilderness.
Oh, gosh. Thank God.
While the news has brought closure to the community, the moment is bittersweet.
I just wish they could have found her alive, though. It's too bad.
In exchange for Courtney giving police information on where the body was located, prosecutors dropped the possibility of the death penalty.
So the discovery of her body did bring some closure to their family and to the community that had waited 5 years at this point just to find out what had happened. Now, as part of the plea framework, in addition to dropping some other counts, the Oregon district's attorney agreed to seek Joel to have his incarceration for the Oregon crime to be served in New Mexico so they didn't have to keep moving him around. Now, as for the Wilberger family, the recovery of her body was also devastating, but also gave them some relief because, you know, after years of searching and wondering, they finally knew where she was. I mean, so it was devastating because, of course, the details that they learned and just the confirmation that she was dead was, of course, their worst fears. Cami Wilberger had later said that in her heart, she had kind of already accepted Brooke's death, but bringing her home was a relief and it was a gift to her. It allowed them to grieve fully and to remember her as she had lived, not just as she had been lost. So Joel Courtney was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of any parole. He still remains incarcerated to this day. And while Joel will spend the rest of his life in prison, the Wilbergers continue to try to keep Brooke's memory alive as a daughter, a sister, and just a young woman whose life was taken far too soon. And that was the murder of Brooke Wilberger. I think that this case really highlights the difficult choices that families and prosecutors face in these cases. Unlike, say, Brian Kohlberger, Brooke's family really supported the plea deal agreement. They wanted their answers. They wanted their daughter back. And they were willing to accept like a life sentence rather than the uncertainty and length of a death penalty trial in exchange for that closure. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Just a reminder that you can skip the ads by signing up on Patreon to A Million Other Choices. If you or someone you love has been a victim of violent crime, please use your online directory to access victim services available in all provinces, territories, and states. You can find specialized services for children, Aboriginal people, and survivors of domestic violence. Some provinces have injury compensation or financial assistance programs. If you are in immediate danger, call 911, or if you are thinking of suicide, please call or text 988.